Hello and welcome to Literary Lunch, a light lunch for your literary appetite. I'm Eli and this is my co-host V.
And today, you might say, you guys have won the lottery.
Ouch.
Because we're reading two stories, The Lottery by Shirley Jackson and The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin.
The Lottery was suggested to us by a friend of the podcast, TJ, and V had never read it before. She live texted me her reactions. It was pretty fun.
I still think it's suspiciously similar to The Hunger Games. Derivative much?
The Lottery was written in 1948.
I know how chronology works, Eli. No, just because the author time traveled to steal Suzanne Collins' genius idea.
Hush. We decided to talk about it in comparison with The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin, because The Lottery is a bit shorter than the stories we usually cover, and because we've been wanting to talk about Le Guin for ages.
Correction. Eli has been trying to get me to care about space philosophy for ages.
I just think it's so interesting how she really dives into Dostoevsky's hypothetical
Eli,
from...
Eli, no, you don't. You just read about that in the preface.
What? No, I didn't. I love Dostoevsky.
Okay, so how many of his books have you read?
Well, now it's time for the synopsis.
In The Lottery by Shirley Jackson, we see villagers gathering on a beautiful day for some kind of annual ceremony. Boys are putting rocks in their pockets and piling them up around the town square.
Not ominous at all.
The men, women, and children all gather in these separate areas to chat while they wait for things to get started.
And if you think any of these people are on edge, especially the woman who arrives late, you'd be wrong.
We talk a lot about tradition and how the other towns abandoning the lottery are dooming themselves to bad harvests. The lottery has been going on for so long that no one remembers why, only that it's always been done.
Tradition! Tradition!
Eli, we agreed, no singing on the pod.
Right, sorry. I thought it was funny.
The townsfolk pick pieces of paper from a very old box. The woman who came in late has one with a black mark on it. They stone her to death in the town square while she whines about how unfair it all is.
I mean, I feel like she's allowed to complain here.
Notice how she doesn't complain until she was the one being sacrificed, though.
Touché. Well, luckily, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas by Ursula K. Le Guin isn't about human sacrifice for the sake of half-forgotten tradition.
Yay!
Everyone knows exactly why this human sacrifice is necessary.
Yay!
Le Guin introduces us to the city of Omelas, a perfect paradise city that's having its summer festival. There's processions, music, naked horse racing, orgies, all the typical wholesome summer fun you'd expect.
So far, so good. Sounds like, what is that thing in the U.S.? Burn the man? Man
Burning
the man.
Man.
Okay, sorry, we can cut that out.
No, it's okay, I think it's funny. But then we find out about the central horror that keeps Omelas running. If they want to have a happy city with all the luxury they could want, they have to keep a child locked in a dark basement room, alone and miserable, forever.
So how do those two things connect? Like, how does that work exactly?
That's not important, but everyone in the city knows about the child, and the implicit societal bargain they've all struck is that they will let the child suffer so that everyone else in Omelas can be supremely happy.
Like the Doctor Who episode with the giant space whale?
Yeah, basically. But there are some people, teenagers who just found out about the child, or adults who suddenly can't take it anymore, who silently walk out of the city and into the unknown wilderness, rejecting the bargain and leaving everyone they know behind.
And now... for the lightning round review.
I am not making a Hunger Games joke. Do not put in...
The Hunger Games meets The Matrix, meets Plato, meets Aristotle, meets...
Now you're just naming philosophers and... The Matrix? Stop. I, too, live a life of happiness and order until the other shoe drops and then I'm like... Oh, there is always a price.
Unless you look at my ex on Instagram, there is no price. He's just happy.
I'm sure his life has ups and downs too, just like everybody else's.
Nope, Instagram is the beacon of eternal truth. I, too, look at a child in a basement pissing themselves and know that that child, specifically somehow keeps society functioning. So logical. So much sense is made here.
Hey, it does make sense. I mean,
you can't even come up with a funny quip to explain the causation here. Ha. Now for the discussion. So for this discussion, we have divided the conversation into a few parts. The first being before the horrible thing is revealed, which would be happiness in Omelas and order in the lottery. First, we're going to talk about Omelas and then the lottery and then the comparison in each subsection.
All right, take it away, V.
So in Omelas, the horrible thing, which is the pissing child in the basement, is alluded to by the author, claiming there is no catch, which is a very smart mind game to play, because I kind of knew there was a fucking catch, especially when you tell me there is no catch to this happiness. I'm like, when is the other shoe going to drop? Thank you very much. In a quote, Le Guin says, "The trouble is that we have a bad habit, encouraged by pedants and sophisticates, of considering happiness as something rather stupid. Only pain is intellectual, only evil interesting. This is the treason of the artist, a refusal to admit the banality of evil and the terrible boredom of pain. If you can't lick him, join him. If it hurts, repeat it. But to praise despair and to condemn delight and embrace violence is to lose hold of everything else."
Yep. Yeah, we all know that one artistic guy in your creative writing class who's like, what is bad for the heart is good for the art, and pain is artistic. Like, okay. But she is catching on to a fundamental trap that happiness is somehow simplistic or primitive, that pain is modern and complex, which doesn't have to be true. And the happiness doesn't even have to be like innocent, pure Garden of Eden, fig leaves style happiness.
Yeah, like in a quote, she literally says, "I fear that Omelas so far strikes some of you as goody-goody. Smiles, bells, parades, horses, bleh. If so, please add an orgy."
Which, by the way, I absolutely love. So then Le Guin gives us a lot of leeway to imagine the kind of happiness that's in Omelas, because, as she says, happiness is based on a just discrimination of what is necessary, what is neither necessary nor destructive, and what is destructive. In the middle category, however, that of the unnecessary but undestructive, that of comfort, luxury, exuberance, etc., they could perfectly well have central heating, subway trains, washing machines, and all kinds of marvelous devices not yet invented here. Floating light sources, fuelless power, a cure for the common cold. Or they could have none of that. It doesn't matter. As you like it.
So basically the utopia is very fluid, and it's kind of like an as-you-like-it deal. It's based on the wild imaginations of the reader's conceptions of happiness. The idea being that citizens of Omelas can have everything they want, everything they need, however that would look for any reader.
Meanwhile, in the lottery, the status quo that they fight so hard for is very much just a subsistence sort of living. And they aren't fighting for ultimate happiness, they're fighting for order, for upholding their society by whatever means necessary. And there's one line that's really telling where Mrs. Hutchinson, who is the woman who ends up being sacrificed, says, "Wouldn't have me leave my dishes in the sink now, would you, Joe?" when she arrives late to the ceremony. And everyone laughs and kind of accepts it and moves on. And it's kind of interesting because even on the most important day of the year, you can't leave any part of your house in disorder. And Jackson really hammers that point home when she has this old crotchety man in the middle of the crowd talking to someone who muses that other towns are starting to abandon the lottery. And he complains about, he complains about kids these days and how you shouldn't listen to the youths, because next thing you know, they'll be wanting to go back to living in caves. Nobody work anymore. Live that way for a while. Used to be a thing about lottery in June, corn be heavy soon. First thing you know, we'd all be eating stewed chickweed and acorns.
This reminds me of those articles that are like, millennials have killed, insert anything here, from fitted sheets to marriage to whatever millennials have killed. But honestly, this is just kind of trying to show how there's that big fear that without the lottery, without the tradition, without the known ways, society would crumble, you know? And it's all kind of that big dramatic headline.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also kind of interesting because they have abandoned parts of this tradition. A lot of the pomp and circumstance has fallen away into sort of making it seem more banal and everyday, and like it's not such a big deal. And I think it's interesting to see which parts of this old ceremony are important and a vital part of tradition, and which parts can just fall along the wayside. So, for example, at one time, some people remembered, there had been a recital of some sort performed by the official of the lottery, a perfunctory tuneless chant that had been rattled off duly each year. Some people believe that the official of the lottery used to stand just so when he said or sang it. Others believe that he was supposed to walk among the people. But years and years ago, this part of the ritual had been allowed to lapse.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Definitely the bones of the ritual are still there. Like the box that has pieces of the box, like the physicality of reaching in and grabbing a piece of paper and, you know, stoning someone to death. Like the essence of it is still there. And one has to wonder that if the pomp and circumstance has faded away, will the essence ever fade away? Or is this the kind of situation where the essence will always stay no matter how much you dilute the traditions surrounding it?
Mm-hmm. And no matter if anyone even remembers why the lottery was instituted in the first place, beyond just a vague idea that if we continue with the lottery, then we will have good harvests.
Yep. What is bad for the people is good for the corn, I guess. That didn't even rhyme. Moving on. For our mini comparison, we just wanted to reiterate that the lottery is more about having kind of an orderly, kind of functional society, like you would see in the Hunger Games, where people aren't in the districts, at least in the Hunger Games, aren't really, you know, rich. They're really just getting by in like most YA dystopia settings, whereas Omelas is more about fluid and energetic happiness.
And what's interesting is that both of these stories start with a very sort of positive description of the goings-on, and they sort of show the sort of everyday things people are doing, or in the case of Omelas, the grand festivities. But when V was reading this, she was waiting for the other shoe to drop on both the whole time she was reading it, which I think is a really illustrative of how the authors did with building that that tension behind the order or the happiness.
Indeed. And now we're going to talk about point two, which is the revelation of the horrible thing and what this means. We're going to start with Omelas, talk about the lottery, and then again talk about comparison. Take it away, Eli.
Sure. Do you believe? Do you accept the festival, the city, the joy? No? Then let me describe one more thing. Which is when Le Guin drops the bombshell that the only reason that Omelas is happy and successful and everyone's la-da-da-da, having orgies, having a great time, is because in a horrible little part of the city, in a horrible little basement, in a horrible dark little room, they are keeping a child locked away with no human contact, only the barest amount of food it needs to survive, completely alone and completely miserable forever. And everyone goes to see the child at some point when in their adolescence. And every single person in Omelas knows that the only reason they're happy is because somewhere a child is in pain. Well, it's not about the logical part of it as much. It's more about sort of, I guess it's more of a parable than anything else. It's a parable for, say, capitalism and how it really relies on the suffering of others in order for the happiness of a few.
Yes. I'm just giving it all the shit it can get, because that's what I do with every story I read. But it is...
Oh, no, that's why... That's why I put on my highbrow hat, and you actually make things funny.
What can I say? I'm really funny. My parents think I'm funny. My mom once told me I'm funny. Anyway, so in a quote, describing the reaction of some of the adolescents to what they witness, Le Guin writes, "Night falls. The traveler must pass down village streets between the houses with yellow-lit windows and on out into the darkness of the fields. Each alone, they go west or north. Towards the mountains, they go on. They leave Omelas. They walk ahead into the darkness, and they do not come back. The place they go towards is a place even less imaginable to most of us than the City of Happiness. I cannot describe it at all. It is possible that it does not exist, but they seem to know where they are going, the ones who walk away from Omelas." And in a way, Omelas's world is even more poignant, because you could forget seeing a kid one time in a basement. You could kind of gaslight yourself into thinking it didn't happen, convince yourself it's not a big deal. But, you know, there's a reinforcement in witnessing a stoning every single year, and you'll always remember it's a threat to your life personally. And there seems to also be no way to really leave the City of the Lottery. Like, everyone's just kind of there. But with Omelas, there's this whole thing with walking out into nowhere, which I think is also really interesting. And I just wonder what that liminal space is like for those teenagers who suddenly learn the price of their happiness and decide to leave. You know, if they don't immediately eat, like, 2 minutes later, like, if they stay a few days and think about it. Like, I can't imagine that moral dilemma of really knowing that the price of your existence is being paid by a pissing child in a basement, and that existence at the same time includes parties, orgies, wealth, and plenty. And there really is no such freedom in the lottery for being able to consider that and make your own decision about it. You know, there's no decisions to be made in the lottery.
Yeah, literally no decisions here.
Well, unless you count picking the paper as a decision.
I don't think that counts. It's supposed to be random chance. It's a lottery. Yeah. Meanwhile, in the lottery, there's no moment where you sit and think really hard about what your society is built on and what has to happen in order for it to continue. There's just blind acceptance and following of tradition, no matter what it means. So the story ends with, "Tessie Hutchinson was in the center of a cleared space by now, and she held her hands out desperately as the villagers moved in on her. 'It isn't fair,' she said. A stone hit her on the side of the head. 'It isn't fair. It isn't right,' Mrs. Hutchinson screamed, and then they were upon her." And it's a really affecting scene. Like, it just gives you chills to read this happening, because before they stone her, you see her laughing and joking with the people she knows in the village, her friends, her family. And now, like, they're helping little children to throw stones at her and just stone her to death in a really brutal way. Like, it isn't even just, "Oh, well, you lost the lottery. You gotta, we're gonna hang you or shoot you or do something that'll end it quickly." It's literally one of the slower and more torturous ways to die. And every single person in town has to have an active hand in your death. But she never says they shouldn't be doing it until it's her head on the line.
Yeah, and even then she says, "I think we ought to start over. You didn't give him enough time to choose, you know, and it's not, I think we should start a revolution and fix the lottery, you know?" And like you were saying, everyone has a hand in it. There's no anonymity to this sense of exacted, like, justice or whatever that allows society to continue. you know, there's no you witness something once and then memory's a funny thing and you can put it far, far, far behind you. This is, no, I will kill someone with my rock-armed hands. And that is, I was trying to say bare hands, but I guess they're not bare if they have rocks in them. With my, you know, rock-armed hands and, like, witness their bloody, brutal murder.
And cause their bloody, brutal murder.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the interesting comparisons between the lottery and the ones who walk away from Omelas. Because in the lottery, like we were saying earlier, the moral objection comes from the victim of the stoning when she's selected, and not like in Omelas, where the moral objection happens even though people are not directly affected by it. And their lives are not in imminent danger from it, and they don't ever have to see it again. But knowing that this violence is being carried out, this violence of an action, is too much for them to contemplate, so they leave.
And I thought it was interesting, too, how, okay, in Omelas, people leave, but in both stories, there's no real attempt to make lasting change. There's the sense that things simply are of a way that they are, and they have been that way, and they will be that way indefinitely. You know, like, we all want to think we'd start the Katniss Everdeen Revolution. We all want to think we'd walk away from Omelas, if not start the Omelas Revolution. But, like, why isn't that an option in the story? I want some character called Omerness Omerdeen.
No, you really
don't. Okay. But these thought experiments exist for a reason. You know, they're based on some degree of reality. And people can and do turn off the news and live their lives. And these things have happened during horrible historic events. Which is not to say that there haven't been revolutions or that people aren't powerful. But there are times when people stone the lottery winner or loser, depends on how you look at it. And there are times when people sunbathe at Omelas, which is this sense of willful blindness, you know?
Yeah, like I was saying, it's violence through inaction. Something that I think keeps coming up for you, V, is that neither story really explored the history behind either occurrence, because in these thought experiments, in these parables, whatever you want to call them, the history doesn't matter. The why doesn't matter. The how did this happen doesn't matter. It's just, this is how it is. The status quo is violence. In the lottery and in Omelas.
And I think that really shows the cheap price that people will accept on the value of human lives.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Like, there's not even a demand for a real explanation in either case.
One of the things that really fascinates me about the comparison between these two stories is that in the lottery, we have a huge personal and yearly sacrifice in order to maintain a really basic society. One person per year in this village of 300 people. That is tiny. That's smaller than a lot of high schools. One person per year is stoned to death in the town square. Not for wealth or anything else, but so that these people can keep living in their crappy little farming town and reaping a decent enough harvest to keep going. It's not about prosperity, but about continued survival. It shows the inherent brutality of living on very little and the lengths you'll go to in order to keep what little you do have.
Yeah, and in that way, there's almost something worse about Omelas and more sinister, mm-hmm. because these people are okay with the suffering of someone because they have everything.
Yes.
And they're not just trying to survive in that sense. They're living it large, you know, they're living that celebrity lifestyle.
Yeah.
like, you know, party on the cruise or something, but...
Yeah, like, instead of having a yearly ritual in which the whole town gathers to do active violence, and anyone at any time could be on the receiving end of that violence, the type of violence created in Omelas is fundamentally violence of an action. It's the kind of violence that is easy to explain away, not because of tradition or because you believe you need it to survive, but because it is concretely connected to the prosperity of the city. You're never going to be the one suffering if you live in Omelas. All your suffering is being carried by a child that you only have to see once in your life, and then if you like, you can compartmentalize that away and never think about it again. You can very easily justify it to yourself. It's the kind of violence that, I think, tends to be at the heart of an advanced society, so-called. As long as the ones suffering for your comfort are tucked away out of sight, you can enjoy the benefits of their exploitation gives you.
Did someone say capitalism?
I think I did a couple times.
Because capitalism. Which place would you rather live in? Why is my concluding question. If you can't start the revolution, that is. If you're just doomed to live in these places how they're presented in the stories.
Yeah, that's a really hard question because for me, at least on the ethical side of things, I think it would be better for my soul, shall we say, to live in the town of the lottery, the world of the lottery, because it's horrible and brutal. It's constant, almost. It happens every year, but at the same time, you really own that this is happening, that you have a part in this, and that it could happen to you at any time. Whereas in Omelas, even if you reject the life of Omelas, you ultimately can't take that child out of its prison because then you destroy everyone else's happiness in that city. And that is just too great a responsibility to take on. So all you can do is walk away. And that's just... That's rough.
That's actually true. Because, and this is going to sound kind of messed up as well, but I just thought of this. I bet the folks in the lottery kind of feel like if 58 people throw a rock at someone who dies, then each person is like 1/58 responsible for their death.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's almost like you can democratize someone's death. Not really, you know, in the sense that everyone has a hand in the final outcome and, you know, you're not like the murderer. Whereas in Omelas, if you just see this kid in a basement, then it feels like, in a way, it feels like you're either complicit or you're not. There's no like 1/58 rock throwing.
Yeah, that's really smart. I had not thought of that.
I know. What can I say? It's like I'm an English major or something. I would probably actually pick Omelas because of the power to walk away. Like, I don't know. The lottery world seems really sketchy in terms of freedoms. And both are the ultimate moral imprisonment. But at least Omelas folks are free to be conditionally happy or lost at whatever the beyond is. And I think I hate both. And I want to start the revolution. You know what? That's my answer. I break the question. I'm starting the revolution. Onto the rating.
All right. So, we have decided to rate these stories 4 out of 5 losing lottery tickets each.
Because I can't eat 10 fucking sandwiches in one sitting.
And you could eat 5 in our previous rankings.
Maybe?
No, I know your appetite. You eat like a delicate little baby bird. It's okay. We can just make them itty bitty little finger sandwiches.
Shut up. Never the conclusion. Conclude.
All right. So, thank you so much for listening to today's episode of Literary Lunch. If you would like to support the podcast, you can donate to our coffee at ko-fi.com/literarylunch. You could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, which always, always helps. And if you want to get in touch with us and maybe suggest a short story we should do or comment on our episodes, you can find us on Twitter at LitLunchCast and on Instagram at Literary Lunch. Bye.
Bye, munchies.